from WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Spiders fascinate, always have. They're all over our stories, from Ovid to Tolkien, J.K. Rowling, James Bond, E.B. White, and Charlotte's Web. Occasionally charming, usually creepy-crawly. A new exhibit at the American Museum of Natural History says there's nothing to be afraid of. Well, only a little. That spiders are, in fact, beautiful, helpful creatures, necessary creatures, and the museum wants to prove it to you by getting you up close and personal with arachnids. This hour on Point, the amazing world of spiders. You can join the conversation. What do you think of spiders? Are you fascinated, freaked? What's your amazing spider story? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Later in this hour, we will hear from a materials scientist who says that spiders' silk may be the way to the building materials of the future on Earth and in space. But first, joining us from New York City is Norm Platnick, curator of the American Museum of Natural History's new exhibit, Spiders Alive. He's spent a lifetime studying spiders, has himself found some 1,600 species. Norm, welcome to On Point. Great to have you.
Thanks, Tom. Great to be here.
Also with us from New York is Hazel Davies, manager of living exhibits at the American Museum of Natural History. Hazel is managing the live spiders included in the new exhibit. Hazel, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Tom.
There's so much we want to learn here, but first, Norm, what has led you to studying spiders for a lifetime? We're going to come to the museum and check it all out, but you've been doing it all your life. What is it about spiders? Why not, you name it, anything else? Why spiders?
Well, what keeps it interesting is that every morning I can come in and sit down at my microscope and look at something that no one on this planet has ever examined before.
How is that possible? Haven't we looked a lot at spiders?
We have. Scientists so far have discovered over 43,000 different species of spiders, but even our rosiest estimates suggest that that's only about halfway there. There are at least another 40,000, perhaps many more, still to be discovered, and there are large parts of the world that have been very little explored.
How can it be, though, after all of our eons on this planet, there's still maybe half the spider population of the world that is unknown to us or unidentified?
Well, actually, biologists know well only the groups that are large and conspicuous. So vertebrates, animals, and green plants tend to be pretty well known. Finding new species of mammals, for example, or large plants is not an extremely common event these days. But for most of the diversity of life on this planet, you're talking about organisms that are much smaller, harder to find, and there making new discoveries is as easy as walking outside.
Many of them are very tiny. Some of them are very big. Hazel, give us a little tour of the spiders that you have on display for the new exhibit. I mean, some of these I had never heard of. The Goliath bird eater. What is that?
That's a species of tarantula from South America. That is the largest species that we have on exhibit. We have 19 different species as part of the overall exhibit.
I'm reading here in your kit that these can eat snakes, mice, frogs, rarely, but even sometimes birds?
They can. They tend to go after smaller prey items, but they will tackle anything that's about their size, slightly bigger than themselves.
A fishing spider, what's that? Does it really go fishing?
In a way, it does. The fishing spider sits at the edge of water with its front legs out on the surface, and it uses its front legs to feel vibrations in or on the water, and then it will run out to grab that prey. It can actually tell the difference between vibrations that's just the wind blowing across the water or if it's something struggling, moving, that could be a prey item. It'll take insects off the water surface and tadpoles and things.
So it's not really going for trout or salmon,
no.
But maybe a tadpole. Can it actually eat a tadpole, Norm?
Oh, yes.
Normally they can.
Yeah, spiders are generalist feeders. They'll eat anything they can manage to catch.
And that's some pretty good-sized catch right there. African whip spiders, sort of very unique tendril coming off there. What is that, Norm?
It's a different group of arachnids. Spiders, of course, are not insects. They're arachnids. Insects have three body parts. Arachnids have two body parts. Insects typically have six legs. Arachnids have eight legs. But there are lots of different kinds of arachnids besides spiders. Scorpions, mm-hmm. for example, harvestmen or granddaddy long legs, even mites and ticks mm-hmm. are different groups of arachnids.
So the African whip spider, they have these feelers maybe 10 inches long out in front yes. of the critter?
Yeah, those are modified from the front pair of legs, and obviously, much like the antennae of insects, they allow them to explore quite a lot of territory.
As they move forward, they're looking for prey, looking for safety, I assume.
Right.
And then, Hazel, you've got giant vinegaroon, the stinky spider, or potentially stinky.
We do. Again, it's another type of arachnid. It looks kind of odd, kind of a cross between a scorpion. It has no stinger in its tail. It has a very thin whip-like tail. And its main means of defense is spraying basically acetic acid or vinegar smell at anything that might be trying to prey upon it. Gives it a chance to try to escape while it kind of startles its predator.
So you and your staff are handling these live spiders as part of this exhibit, I guess. You know, even if just in their I don't know what you call it, cage.
We call them habitats.
Very good. Sounds so nice.
Right. Obviously a lot of them we don't handle. That wouldn't be a good idea. The brown recluse, the black widows, the
poisonous.
Ornamental tarantulas.
Mm-hmm.
They're poisonous. They are venomous, and we definitely don't want to get bitten. We understand the behavior of the spiders, and we use that to our advantage of kind of knowing how they're likely to behave. That helps us know how that we can handle them.
Has the vinegaroon been spraying you with its skunky spray?
It has not. It has not sprayed once, which means it feels quite comfortable, hopefully. That's a good sign, I think.
And what about feeding them? How often, how much, what?
It varies. Some of them eat twice a week. Some of them we just offer them food once a week. We generally feed them other arthropods, a varied diet as much as we can, because they can't get all the nutrients they need from one food source. A lot of crickets, different species of cockroaches, flies, tomato hornworms, the big juicy caterpillars. So different prey items for different species. And also some of the species eat several different prey items.
We're going to talk about many features of the spider in this hour and look with a material scientist at spider silk and what we may learn from that. Norm, I know this is not your view. You've dealt with them all your life. I've seen the video. You've got a love for these creatures, these animals. Many people do not. In fact, many are just freaked out. Why do you think that is exactly, Norm?
It's difficult to say. I mean, I can understand being scared of snakes, for example, because a fair proportion of the snakes on this planet can actually hurt you. It isn't rational to be afraid of spiders in that same way. Now, it is true that almost all spiders have venom, but that venom has evolved to paralyze insects, the natural food mm-hmm. Of most species. And if the venom has an effect on humans, it's just an accident of chemistry. It's not a venom that's aimed at vertebrates at all.
Well, who cares now, if you're a human, if it's an accident or on purpose? I mean,
is that, many spiders are too small to even break your skin.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you manage to get bitten, and you have to work to be bitten generally, but even if you are bitten, in almost all cases, the venom will have no effect whatsoever because it's evolved to work.
Wasn't designed to get you, right.
Exactly. But there are a few rare exceptions where the venom does have an effect on vertebrates. And in the U.S., for example, there are only two kinds of spiders that you need to worry about, the black widows and the brown recluse.
And those show up where, Norm?
Well, brown recluse are natively a southern species, so they're found in the south and southwestern U.S. normally. But they do some live in houses, and as a result, they can sometimes be transported to the north in cartons mm-hmm. and boxes. And they can survive indoors. They don't spread in the north because they can't survive the winters outdoors.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But they might be introduced and brought in. And black widows are native to North America and most of the rest of the world, so they can be found just about anywhere. Again, neither one is particularly common. Neither one is aggressive. Brown recluse, as the recluse name says, I mean, they tend to live, on the ground or on windowsills. They're not Well, it's like any spider. Their first reaction, if possible, is to get as far away as possible from
what's
anything.
What's it take to get them in stinging or biting mode, I should say?
Well, if a spider happens to get caught in your clothes or in your bedding and you're crushing it to death and it can't escape, then it may bite as a last resort. But again, unless it's one of the very few kinds of spiders, it's going to have no effect. And it's really not terribly different from bees, for example. I mean, bees, after all, sting, and therefore mm-hmm. some people don't like them. But the fact is, if bees weren't around, we'd be in serious trouble because most of our crops would not get pollinated. The same thing is true for spiders. If the spiders weren't here to eat the insects, then insect populations would expand enormously and they would devour all our food. So we depend on these organisms.
So take your pick, a tidal wave of insects or some lovely spiders around
you. Exactly. And that's true even in your house. I mean, you know, if you see a spider in your house, the point is, yeah, it's going to be controlling the insect populations there.
Hey, it's so great to have both of you here. We're going to learn a lot more about the exhibit and the whole world of spiders. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point with the Ramones and You Know What. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about spiders and why we need them. There's a big new exhibit at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, and there are probably plenty in your backyard, your barn, your basement, your garage. With us this hour, Norm Plotnick. He is curator of the museum's new exhibit, Spiders Alive, curator emeritus of the museum's Department of Invertebrate Zoology. I should say you can see at our website right now a bunch of the spiders included in the exhibit at onpointradio.org. Norm has spent a lifetime studying spiders, has discovered 1,600 species. Hazel Davies is with us. She's manager of living exhibits at the museum, and they have a lot of those. They've had many different kinds over time, but right now, I mean, she's done lizards and snakes and famously butterflies. Right now, it's spiders. A range of human responses, sometimes charming. Here's a little bit from E.B. White's 1952 children's book, Charlotte's Web. The young pig Wilbur enlists the help of Charlotte to save him from being turned into Christmas dinner. Here's Debbie Reynolds as Charlotte, 1973.
My name is Charlotte. Charlotte A. Cavatica.
I think you're beautiful.
Well, I am pretty. Almost all spiders are nice looking. I'm not as flashy as some, but I'll do.
About saving my life. Do you really think you can?
Oh, just a minute, Wilbur. He'll make a perfect breakfast for me.
Ooh, you mean you eat flies?
Well, certainly. I eat anything that gets caught in my web.
Not always that cute and cuddly 1990 horror comedy film Arachnophobia. Jeff Daniels.
I was just physically unable to stop it from crawling along my naked skin. I can still feel its hairy little legs, just then up to my face. You know, it's just a feeling of utter helplessness, being explored by an alien thing, that's all.
An alien thing panting in fear in Harry Potter, Chamber of Secrets. Ron Weasley forced to confront his crippling arachnophobia. Harry drags him after a trail of spiders.
Come on.
What?
You heard what Hagrid said. Follow the spiders.
Head into the dark forest. Wait, spiders? Why couldn't we follow the butterflies?
Why not butterflies? But it's spiders right now at the Museum of Natural History, and there is a lot to learn. We need them, they say. Without them, a whole lot more insects. Yuri's calling from Linfield, Massachusetts. Yuri, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
Thank you for taking my call. Tom, your speakers answered my question, but I would like to make a quick comment. I work as a primary care physician in Salem, Massachusetts.
Uh-huh.
And me and my colleagues, we see a lot of so-called spider bites. people come with complaints and some skin lesions and believe they have, the spiders bit them. But in fact, when you ask a few more questions, you never see spiders per se. They do believe. So it's very common then that people believe that these spiders bite. And I don't think it's the case. I just want your speakers to comment on that.
So the doctor is in. People come to you complaining of spider bites, and they don't turn out to be spider bites. Norm, are you nodding along there in New York?
Absolutely. He is absolutely correct. We arachnologists accept evidence of spider bites only if the specimen is observed and captured. And the number of records of real bites that are can be documented in that way is very small.
Let's get one from Curryville, Missouri. Damon is calling. Damon, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'm so happy to be on. I usually hear this program as a recording, so I found a station that's actually live.
Great. Wonderful. Well, welcome. What's your story, Damon?
All right. So, you know, and just what the previous caller just said, just the other day, my girlfriend was telling me she had a spider bite, and I just thought, you know, I don't think that's right. How do you know it's a spider? And, you know, it's just always funny because growing up, we just assumed they were always spider bites. But I don't really believe that anymore. And I'm glad to hear a doctor back that up.
How do you see spiders? What spiders do you see in your habitat, Damon?
Well, I just happen to adopt compassion kind of as a religious system as being kind of a high principle. So I started giving bugs a chance. And I'm not scared to pick bugs up anymore. And I just, even spiders, in all my life growing up, I was terrified of spiders. But I've changed it, and now I pick them up. The only thing, you know, I'm scared of brown recluse. And my mother's house is saturated with brown recluse. Her shed outside, the concrete, it seems like they like concrete and hiding underneath objects. And her house and her shed is full of them.
No, but those in fact, are poisonous. They are dangerous. Do you have your same compassion with them, Damon?
I've taken a few outside of her house, but I have to admit I crushed a few weeks ago. But usually I don't kill any bugs. But the brown recluse scares me.
Damon, you're an admirable soul, and I'm glad you were calling. There from Damon, Missouri. Norm, you know, there's a man who has a philosophical commitment to giving bugs a chance. Even he worries a little about the brown recluse population in his mom's shed.
No, that's understandable, and one obviously needs to exercise caution. But the fact is, there are people living in houses that have had brown recluse populations for years and years and years, and have relatively high populations, and there's still no recorded bites. Again, you don't look like prey to a spider, so it's not going to, you know, seek you out in order to bite you.
We've got listeners with questions online. Yar says, "I've read that you're never more than 3 feet from a spider. Does that make sense to you, Norm?"
It's probably a little bit exaggerated. We tend to say 7 or 8 feet, but by and large, yeah, it's pretty much true. Again, you have to realize that many of them are very tiny, and so you really have to look. But even in a building, you're probably not that far from the closest spider.
And here's another from online. Max says, "Can one of your guests address the urban legend, maybe, that the average American swallows about 8 spiders a year in their sleep?"
That is definitely legend.
Okay, just not that many, not going down the old
exactly.
The old maw. Jennifer in Hopkinton, Massachusetts. Jennifer, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call.
Yeah.
The reason I'm calling is because I have to tell you that my entire life was deathly afraid of spiders, all kinds of spiders. And believe me, we had a bunch in my parents' house, and they always freaked me out. And then my husband and I took a whitewater rafting trip down the Colorado River, and our guide called us all over one night before dinner and said, "I want you to see something." And he was holding a tarantula on his lap that he just found wandering, you know, along the banks of the river. And his body must have been the size of a tennis ball. So, I mean, with his legs, he was bigger than a grapefruit. And ever since then, my opinion of spiders has completely changed because he let us all hold it. And we then realized that as long as the spider didn't feel threatened, it was going to be very, very gentle and very sweet. And it was a really great experience.
Jennifer, you're brave in Colorado, but also learning something very real there. I mean, Hazel, this brings us to your territory. You've got museum staff who are letting people get pretty close with tarantula and the other arachna, not a spider, but scorpion here. What tarantula are they showing off in your sessions of kind of show and tell there, Hazel?
Well, we have a presentation area where we have the Chilean rosehair tarantula and the emperor scorpion. And basically the idea behind the presentation area is to give that experience that the caller just spoke about to our visitors. A lot of the spiders that they're going to see in the habitats as they look through the exhibit are going to be pretty still most of the time. And we want to be able to give the visitor a closer interaction with the spiders. So the presenters there are, they have a live Chilean rosehair and a live emperor scorpion out at the presentation area. And the visitors are able to get very close to them. They're able to see that the handler can get very close to them. And we want to sort of point out some of the features and show that, yes, the spiders, they're not out to attack you. They are very gentle. The Chilean rosehair is a very docile species, so it's great for using in this setting.
And what kind of shifts do these spiders, do these tarantulas work? How long off, how long on and off? And what you said, you've got what you call dark huts for them to take breaks in. How's it work?
We don't want to stress out the spiders. That's very important. So we actually have 17 Chilean rosehair tarantulas, and they work one day, and then they rest until they're back up again in their rotation. Also, during the day, we do the presentation. We start a new presentation every half an hour. So they're out. We have a camera linked to a big screen so that the visitors can see really close-up features of the spiders. And but in between the sessions, we put them back under the dark hut, put the lids on, and give them a few minutes to rest in between.
That sounds like it. Do they have a labor union, these 17 tarantulas? You got there?
I think they do. It seems to be a very good work schedule for them. We also have so many because as spiders grow, they need to molt their exoskeleton. So it's very important that if it's where one of them is ready to molt and shed their skin, then they... That's quite a very vulnerable time for them, and they're not going to be able to be used for presentation. So we want to make sure that we have plenty in the rotation, that if they if they're molting, they can take a break and they won't work for several weeks.
Norm, how long do spiders live, or what's the range, and what about molting? How often do they do that?
Well, most of the spiders found in the northern U.S., for example, live 1 year. They hatch in the spring. They eat and grow through the spring and summer, get largest in the fall, and then when the first freeze comes, they die. But tarantulas and relatively primitive spiders related to tarantulas can live a long time. So many tarantulas can live 20 or 25 years. And unlike the more common kinds of spiders we find in the north, a female tarantula will continue to molt throughout its life. Most more evolutionarily derived spiders don't molt once they become adults.
So is it sort of like a snake schedule of losing that skin, or...?
It's very similar, actually. Probably in the wild, most tarantulas probably molt about once a year. True spiders, the smaller spiders that we're more familiar with, will molt anywhere from 4 to 7 times before they become adult.
Now the other,
but that will all happen during one season.
The other creature that Hazel and her crew are showing off here are scorpions. Why? They're arachnids. They're in the same part of the tree here, but they're not spiders. What's the point in bringing them into the spider exhibit, Norm?
Well, we're trying to show the diversity of life on the planet. You have to, as an urban institution, many of the kids who come to view our exhibitions have little or no contact with the natural world. And we want to present them with some idea of the astounding diversity of things that we do share this planet with.
Let's go to Ken in Clarksville, Tennessee. Ken, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi, Ken. What's on your mind?
A real quick question.
Yeah.
I would like to know if a black widow or a brown recluse or perhaps even a tarantula or a scorpion can bite through a latex or nitrile glove like they should sell in the shops.
Okay, fair enough. Norm, what do you think?
I'm not sure exactly how thick a glove he's speaking of. Brown recluse and black widow, probably not. Tarantula, if you had some way of inducing it to bite, it has a much larger fang and a much larger chelicera. It perhaps could penetrate a glove like that.
You think of a latex glove like maybe a dishwashing glove, just for example. You think it might get
through
that?
Oh, yes. A tarantula could penetrate that. But, I mean, we all have this vision that comes from Hollywood of, of James Bond lying in terror because a tarantula is crossing his chest, and the only thing he's in danger of is itching a little. The animal's not going to bite him, left to its own devices, but it might use one of its real natural defense mechanisms if it's disturbed. And tarantulas often have what are called urticating hairs on their abdomen, and if disturbed, they'll take their hind legs and they'll scratch those hairs off, and those hairs are shaped like a wasp sting with barbs on them. And if they get in your eyes or your nose or your mouth, they're going to irritate
and
the
skin
mechanically.
And they can kind of shoot those like a little spear, is that
they
right?
They fling them off with their hind legs, yes.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, a lot of your work is done under a microscope, Norm, and there's some amazing photos. Again, look at our website. But you get up close with a spider and there's just amazing contours and features here that maybe in our fear or in their small size, we don't often see. I mean, that carapace there, head, incredible looking things. It looks like a lot of, you know, we seem to model, I don't know, space, you know, alien ships out of spider bodies almost.
Technology like scanning electron microscopes has radically changed our ability to image very small animals, including even the smallest of spiders like the ones that you're talking about. And their structures are just incredibly complex and diverse.
So what can we learn? There's a lot we can learn. We'll talk about silk in a minute with a material scientist. You mentioned venom. What about just the structure of the spider? Is it a strong structure? Is it, you know, what's the I don't know, evolutionary purpose of those very unusual looking body structures? Maybe we're the unusual looking ones, I suppose. To a spider, we are, but to our eye, anyway.
Well, in terms of a diversity of species, obviously they're enormously successful, and they've been here for hundreds of millions of years. So evolutionarily, there's no question of their success compared to ours.
Here before the dinosaurs, I think I read.
Yes. Spiders were among the very first organisms on land. They weren't the first. There had to be something here, some insects presumably, for them to eat. They're predators.
And we were talking about silk, and I think it's you who told us, Norm, that many spiders have different kinds of silk. Like what?
Yes. An individual spider can have as many as 7 different kinds of silk glands in its abdomen, and each different kind of gland produces silk with different physical properties, and they're used for different things. I mean, we all tend to think of the geometric orb webs as being typical of what spiders do, but actually only about half of the species of spiders spin a web at all to catch their food. But they all use their silk for something. So, for example, almost all females will use silk to wrap their eggs when they're laid and create an egg case.
Okay.
Many spiders lay down a drag line as they move. So if they happen to fall, their silk drag line stays attached and they can just climb back up the silk.
So there's sort of traveling or safety. There's eggs. Many of them wrap their prey as well, right? Once they've...
Absolutely. The silk helps them subdue the prey while the venom is going to work paralyzing it. Another unusual use of silk is for what's called ballooning. Many small spiders can climb up to the top of vegetation and emit a strand of silk from their spinneret that gets carried off by the wind. When it gets long enough, the spider releases its hold on the plant and gets blown away in the wind, and it's one of the ways they disperse. So ballooning spiders have been found 200 miles out in the ocean, landing on ships.
That is
amazing. Very high up in the air.
That is amazing. I mean, it sort of explains why I've been amazed just at some of the great expanses across which you find webs built, and you wonder, how did they get the first strand across? But if they can go 200 miles, they can certainly go 6-7 feet.
Yeah, getting that first strand across is probably the most difficult part of building a large orb web.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about spiders. There's a big new exhibit at the American Museum of Natural History in New York City with all kinds of spiders, shows and background, history, all the rest, and it looks at the importance of spider diversity and how important they are to us in many ways, not least keeping down the insect population, which would balloon without them. Norm Plotnick is curator of the new exhibit. He's with us from New York. Hazel Davies is here as well. She's manager of living exhibits at the museum, and this is definitely a living exhibit. Norm Hazel, here's Elizabeth, writes to us online. My worst experience with spiders was December 2006. The Christmas tree we cut down and brought into the house was infested. That didn't work out too well for her. But here's Kirsten, who writes, she says, your show this hour is reminding me of a favorite poem by Kobayashi Isa. And here it is. Don't worry, spiders. I keep house casually. She says, Isa must have been the same kind of housekeeper I am. Spiders have very little to worry about here in my home. And this one, let me ask you, Norma, about this is from Eric, and a little story here. He says, in our bathroom, we have a towel rack next to the sink that has a bit of a recess in the design. Every year, we have what we call our pet spider. I find it amazing that as I'm shaving, the spider will crawl out of the recess and sit there. If I put my finger close to it, it scampers back to its towel rack home. Do you think this large white house spider is actually looking at me and trying to contemplate what's going on? Do spiders reason and think on any sophisticated level? What do you say, Norm?
Well, most spiders actually have very poor vision. Most have eight eyes, but they're simple eyes. They're not like the compound eyes of a fly. But there are exceptions. Things like jumping spiders and wolf spiders have excellent vision. So I need to know exactly what sort of spider it is. But certainly jumping spiders, for example, can see you. And if you're out in the garden, they will watch you move around because they rely on their vision to catch their prey.
Eric seems kind of very affectionate toward the spider. Casey, another bathroom story. My uncle died from a brown recluse spider bite a few years ago here in Nashville. It was on his robe in the bathroom, got on his chest. When he put on his robe, he noticed it, smashed it into his chest. They were pretty sure the venom got into the bloodstream. Cycle three, he died 3 or 4 days later. Jeez, that's the story you don't want to hear, I guess, Norm.
Certainly not, and it seems a little odd. The black brown recluse venom actually is a tissue destructive venom. It's necrotic, so it destroys the tissue immediately surrounding the area of the bite. There's no reason to expect it to have that kind of systemic effect.
Well, don't know what to say about the doctor's verdict on that one. Dave in Woburn.
Exactly. Again, the first question is, do we have a specimen?
Yeah. Dave in Woburn, Massachusetts. Dave, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Yes. Talking about jumping spiders, they fascinate me. They hibernate in the winter and they live for years. They sleep at night like we do. So they're not, if spiders are biting people, they're not the ones. They seem very intelligent. They know when you're looking at them and they hide. And I've kept them as pets and they're just very, very fascinating. If your guests could talk a little more about jumping spiders.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dave. Hazel, do you have a jumping spider in your collection for the exhibit?
We do have a jumping spider. They are a lot of fun. They definitely look like they, as spiders go, they have a personality. They're very active. And yes, you can see them moving around following where you are, as though they're looking at you, yes.
Very distinct, Norm, from non-jumping spiders in their behavior?
Yes, partly because of their much better vision. But they're also the most diverse family of spiders. One of the things we have on exhibition are some videos of the incredible courtship rituals that males use. And they're very fancily colored and handsome animals. And they use these special dances to impress the females when they encounter them. So that the females, first of all, recognize them as males of their own species and not as food. To be eaten, and to show that they, you know, will be good fathers.
Great eyes, great dancers. Hey, they sound pretty good. We've got people paying attention all over the place. Adam writes in from Omaha, Nebraska. Heartland Scenic Studio says he helped produce this exhibit, I guess, with you guys in New York. Learned so much in the process. So much fun. We've got a terrific guest with us in the studio right now. Marcus Bueller is here. He's professor of material science and engineering at MIT. His research focuses on how spider silk can inform man-made technology and construction and materials. Marcus Bueller, thank you very much for coming in today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So talk to us about spider silk. What do you study there? What can we learn from it? What might we do with some version of it?
Yeah, spiders are, as we've heard, really amazing animals. And if you look at the materials they make and the structures they make, the webs, the silk threads, the different kinds of silk materials they make, they're really, truly amazing as well. We look at the properties of these materials and how they derive their properties. And if you look at this problem or interesting challenge there, is the spider eats the insect, the prey. Mm-hmm. They digest the proteins, and they put these proteins together in something that actually turns out to be stronger than steel.
Is it? What does it mean, stronger than steel? I mean, I can walk right through most spider webs.
Yeah.
I can't walk through, you know, rebar.
That's a really great question. So, you know, the way to look at this is that the spider silk that you have in a web is much, much thinner than any kind of steel you have. So actually, mm-hmm. it's a very, very tiny thread.
So per ounce of it or whatever.
We measure the cross-sectional area of threads, mm-hmm. usually mm-hmm. in engineering, to define the strength. And if you do that, then actually it turns out to be stronger than steel. So if you actually would take silk and you make it as thick as steel, it would have the same properties.
How does a little spider, you know, eat a bunch of whatever it is, ants, and yeah. turn them into something stronger than steel? What are the properties or the structure of it that bring that strength?
It's absolutely amazing. You know, and that really is what led us into trying to understand this, because the spiders have a liquid protein in their bodies, mm-hmm. and they spin that silk, right? They extrude it in a little microscopic device, the spinning duct, and out come these silk fibers that are very strong.
But it's not to make steel, we have huge furnaces
right,
and heat.
Right.
They don't presumably don't have that. Something like that going on.
Exactly.
Inside.
Well, the spiders actually use nanotechnology, and this might sound really surprising and interesting, right? Because they've been around for millions of years. So what they do is they actually control to get that strength out of that very simple protein building block mm-hmm. that they have. They actually control the structure at many different length scales, starting from the nanoscale. So actually, so what we have been trying to do in material science and engineering for the last 50 years and trying to create nanotechnology, the spiders have figured that out already millions of years ago.
So the molecular levels. So what's the trick? What have you figured it out? What makes it so strong in that structure?
Well, one of the things that actually creates very small and tiny structures on the order of a few nanometers, so that's a billionth of a meter, incredibly small structures. Mm-hmm. And so these are the little pieces of material that they create, and they assemble them in very precise geometries. Sort of engineers, we really can't do that because we can't really touch anything on that scale. We really have very little control in most cases about at that scale. Spiders have found a way by controlling the chemistry, the biochemistry of the proteins.
Down to the super right. micro scale, so right. the strength begins all the way down there in the right. tiniest structure of it.
Correct, yeah. And then they have found ways of scaling that strength up to very large levels of a spider web and even larger. So the amazing thing there is that they not only control the nanoscale structure, but actually many different length scales. And so actually, if you look at a spider web, and if you were to sort of, you know, go in with a microscope, and you would subsequently make the magnification larger and larger until you go all the way down, you're going to see immense diversity of structures at many different length scales, something you wouldn't be able to imagine. So I think we were just learning now how that looks like in nature, and we're using this insight to make our own materials.
If we could emulate that, what kind of materials, what kind of applications?
Well, they're really exciting applications in a way that we could use building blocks. Proteins are great building blocks in nature, and they're compatible with a lot of processes there. But they're really not the strongest thing you can start to build from. We have much stronger building blocks like carbon nanotubes and graphene and polymers and metals and ceramics. So if we can copy or mimic the way spiders use this actually weakness of the building block and scale it up and magnify it and synergistically mm-hmm. create
what would you build? Suspension bridges? I don't know.
Yeah,
what?
There are many, you know, many applications. You could think about bridges that would actually be much lighter and thinner. You would need much less material. You could imagine building cars, spaceships, which basically the idea would be, because we talked about the thickness of the silk thread in the beginning in nature, it's very thin. So you could make cars, you could make space shuttles that actually have much, much less material that you would need to put in there. So you can make them much lighter.
But is it imaginable? Can we get to that? Or spiders just have a mastery of this micro, super micro level construction structuring that we can't touch, as you say?
Well, we can. We're starting to do that. And we actually have now with nanotechnology and methods from this field, we can actually start to copy that. And so we're doing this in our research. We actually copy the structures and processes that spiders have. We understand them. We then copy them in our lab, and we basically have setups where we can mimic the way spiders make materials in our lab. And now we can start to play. We can put in all these things that spiders don't even care about, like nanotubes.
Amazing. From the venom, science looks at potential medical cures, epilepsy, Alzheimer's. I read from the silk, we're looking at maybe trying to emulate spiders and the strength of that, maybe even into outer space. Jason in Somerville, Massachusetts. Jason, you're on the air.
Hello, everybody.
Hi.
I do estate liquidation, and I work in houses that have been empty for months at a time sometimes. And recently, we've been working in houses in and around Metro Boston.
Yeah.
And me growing up as an arachnophobe has certainly changed my attitude over the years. There's one property that stands out in particularly, which is inhabited, well, infested by, I'd say, daddy long legs, and they are everywhere. If we're gone for a weekend, we walk back in, it's like Raiders of the Lost Ark all over again. And at one point, one of the guys that works for me gathered up, it must have been a half inch to three quarter inch wad, about 8 inches long, of daddy long leg web. And as he unfurled it off the stick that he had it on, we were trying to stretch this stuff apart.
Yeah.
It just didn't. It would collapse down to maybe a millimeter or two, and we just couldn't do it.
So you're impressed by the kind of otherworldly properties of what they produce.
It is totally incredible at that those properties, but also, you know, me growing up as an arachnophobe, but living in the country, I'd see spiders all the time, and now with what I do, it could be big, black, and hairy, or tiny, little, spindly, and yeah, to move them outside. But a point brought up earlier as well, I'll control the insect population in my house.
Okay,
very much.
Okay. We see the path you're on, but a newfound respect at the same time. Daddy Longlegs, favorite spider, but not even a spider, I think, Norm, or am I wrong?
Well, that's a problem with common names, and that's mm-hmm. why scientists don't use common names.
Mm-hmm.
By daddy longlegs, some people refer to harvestmen, which is a pileonids, a different group of arachnids. Some people also use daddy longlegs for what are often called cellar spiders. They're found often in basements. They have extremely long legs and very interesting behavior, because if they're disturbed, they will whirl those legs so fast that they just become a blur. It makes it hard for a predator to find them. So they're neat animals, but I don't know which one he's talking about.
Okay, it gets complicated. Karen in Virginia Beach, Virginia. Karen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to say that as a gardener, I read many years ago about the Chinese. One of their methods of keeping up with pests in the gardens in their fields, they made little teepees out of bamboo twigs. And they would set that little teepee on the ground and hope that spiders would take up residence, which they invariably do. And then when they observe in their fields and notice, like, a certain section of the field is infested with caterpillars or some kind of
mm-hmm.
pest, they would move these little teepees over to that area so that the spiders would jump off and take care of their problem.
That sounds like wonderful Chinese ingenuity right there, and people who really know what they're doing with nature. Hazel, you must be able to relate to that. I mean, you've got your own sort of version of teepees, different habitats for each species.
We have, and we've tried to make the habitats very comfortable for the species that we've put in there to approximate what they would naturally do in the wild. The habitats are different sizes depending on the species. The web builders have larger enclosures in which to build a nice big orb web, whereas some of the other species have a much smaller space because they don't need that much space and they don't move around so much. So we are encouraging them to set up home in their little habitats in that way, yes.
I love that image of Chinese gardeners putting out their teepees where they need them. Drew in Bedford, Massachusetts. Drew, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Hi. I just had a quick comment about how amazing spider silk is. Once when I was working out in my backyard, I saw a line stretched across two trees that had to have been 50 feet long and 25 feet off the ground. It was just the most amazing thing. And it was up there all afternoon, kind of blowing in the breeze.
Wow. 50 feet. You know, Marcus, I don't know what the human equivalent of that would be. At that scale, that narrow, narrow scale, that would be like a human bridge. I don't know how many miles long.
That's right. Yeah, it's amazing. You know, and that's really because the material is so light. And I was really, you know, intrigued by the earlier comment that the spiders can actually, you know, use the silk to fly hundreds of miles into the ocean. It's absolutely amazing. That's because of the lightness and the strength.
I was reading here about military applications. Do they come knocking on your door?
Yeah, we get a lot of the interest really is in understanding, you know, once you have a material that is very light and very strong and very tough, so toughness is the ability to dissipate energy, and that could be impact energy, and that finds application in military
context. You're talking bulletproof materials? Or?
Right, correct. That's one application. And, you know, on the sort of civilian side, you might imagine this for cars, safety, impact. You know, anytime you want to have a material that doesn't really just break. Right?
So when will the Fiat Spider be made out of spider silk or something like it?
Well, I think a lot of it
is this decades away, or?
Well, there's actually quite some work going on in doing this sort of as we speak. I mean, you know, there are various labs I know that make polymers, and we know in work we make carbon inner tube based fibers that have these kinds of properties, and so it's probably, you know, years away at least for prototypes.
Amazing. Norm Plotnick, we've just got a minute here. What do you most hope that people will take away from their close encounter with spiders at the Museum of Natural History?
Well, I hope they begin to realize that spiders are basically beneficial rather than pest organisms, that they're often just as beautiful and fascinating as butterflies, and they're an important part of the world we live in.
And Hazel, you've got your giant vinegaroon and your Mexican red knee and your Goliath bird eater and your funnel web spider, your golden orb web spider. What draws the most affectionate crowds in the exhibit, Hazel?
Well, I think the crowds that we've seen coming in have all been very curious. They've been asking lots of questions. They've been fascinated to look at the different species. And so that's been a lot of fun seeing their reaction. And I can relate that to being in the butterfly exhibit as well. It's been great to see people going away with that good feeling.
Well, and a good feeling in a part of nature which people may be predisposed to feel otherwise. But you learn more and the fascination grows. It really is some terrific neck of the woods, part of the world and its life. Marcus Bueller at MIT, doing all kinds of research on spider silk and what may come of it. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
And from the American Museum of Natural History, where Spiders Alive goes on the rest of the year, Norm Plotnick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
And Hazel Davies, thanks very much to you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Listeners, thanks. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.